the court. I'd like to reserve about 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Please watch your clock.
Although there are multiple issues that exist in this appeal, there is a central and I believe dispositive issue, which is whether or not Landmark experienced any substantial prejudice as a result of Taisei's July 20th, 2015 request that appointed counsel withdraw. And I think the facts are undisputed here. Landmark did not even allege any existence of substantial prejudice. Landmark presented no evidence of any such prejudice, and even more importantly, no such prejudice existed. Indeed, the underlying Wilshire-Vermont case about which all these defense obligations turned on had concluded by the time the district court, Judge Real, had decided Landmark's motion for summary judgment in September of 2018. Landmark's answering brief at page 39, Landmark says this. He says that actual prejudice is a prejudice that Landmark never encountered. And I'll submit to you that that is a dispositive admission. California law is very clear as to the breach of a breach of cooperation claim. Substantial prejudice is a distinct and separate element from the claim of a breach of the duty of cooperation. Stands apart. Substantial prejudice cannot be presumed. It must be proven, and that burden stands on the insurer. And yet, the district court simply ignored these basic tenets of California law and did what it had done in the Travelers matter, and that matter was reversed and remanded because it conflated what it deemed to be an interference with the right to control with the substantial prejudice element.
At page 39 that you referenced, where you say there was a concession as to the actual prejudice requirement, Lambert goes on to say, though, that the fact pattern of this case does not require it to make that showing. How do you respond?
Well, this is, we're not riding on a clean slate here. As we know, the panel in the Travelers v. Taisei matter already right control does not equal substantial prejudice. And moreover, I think it's important to understand this fact pattern that Taisei accepted counsel and allowed counsel appointed by both Travelers and Landmark for 20 months before he asked the appointed counsel to withdraw. And moreover, it asked counsel to withdraw for what I would suggest was a disputed factual issue as to whether or not that the appointed counsel had been actually providing the defense it was obligated to provide. An insurer under California law is required to provide a full and complete defense, and it was not doing so. And that was the evidence presented to the district court and created a disputed issue of material fact, which was not appropriate for decision under Rule. So I don't think there's any way to marginalize the wealth and the breadth of California case law that there was a mere interference in the right to appoint counsel. And I think really the notion that a insurer is substantially or inherent prejudice. But again, that's not what California law says. California law says that there must be actual prejudice, and it cannot be presumed. So I think on this record, the district court simply erred both by denying Taisei's motion to dismiss, denying Taisei's motion for partial summary judgment, and granting Landmark's motion for summary judgment and ignored factual issues. There are a number of issues out there that go beyond the substantial prejudice issue. For instance, one of them is that at the point in time this decision was made, the declaratory relief cause of action was a moot issue. The underlying case had been resolved. There was no substantial controversy, no present actual controversy on that issue at all. Another big issue that the district the court simply got it wrong on committed error, whether or not you can present a breach of duty of cooperation claim as an affirmative claim rather simply as a defense. I think if you look at the case law in California under Campbell, California Supreme Court case, or Billington, district court's decision in Lanar, Mare Island, district, a case that seems to have been followed by another case, Weber Distribution out of the Central District, all saying that a breach of the duty of cooperation claim is simply a defense that an insurer can put forward, not an affirmative
claim. Why can't it be a breach of contract claim, that being the clause of the contract that's allegedly breached?
Well, the case law says it's not a breach of the contract claim.
I haven't seen case law that says that. Why isn't it a breach of contract?
Well, the one thing, you can go back into the issue of where's the damages.
I hear that. And that's an issue I suspect we'll explore with your colleague. But conceptually, I don't understand why it can't be a breach of contract. And if there are damages, then it's something that would be actionable as a breach of contract. I don't know why the cooperation clause is pulled out as if it's not part of the contract and wouldn't be subject to breach.
I think the procedural posture of these cases may explain that, because it's a factual pattern that simply is not going to arise. So, for instance, in this case, what harm did Landmark establish? Why would an insurer be claiming affirmatively cooperation, when really what it's looking for is its defense obligations or its indemnity obligations? So that
it may be that you're grasping at something to talk about, because we're not peppering you with questions, but I'm just focusing now on what I thought I heard you say and what I thought I saw in your brief, which is that this isn't actionable. Suppose there are damages. Suppose the carrier can say, look, but for the fact they wouldn't use our lawyer and instead, different fact pattern, instead hired their own incompetent hack, and the guy lost the case, and now we're facing this huge bill, and that's all because they wouldn't do what they were supposed to do at the breach of contract. We're entitled to judgment on that. I don't understand any reason why it would not be actionable as a breach of contract, assuming you can show causation and damages and all the other stuff that you need to show.
The practical matter, that claim would only be presented as a defense, because if that scenario played out, the insured would have lost the underlying case and be going against the insured, seeking some sort of indemnity to pay out of policy benefits. And absent that kind of case of the insured going after the insurer, there would be no reason for the insured to go after the insured in that scenario. So I think as a practical matter, you simply don't see it. Again, I think that in all these cases, California Supreme Court cases, have always been, the scenario has been presented as a defense rather than an affirmative claim. That's the best I can respond to your question. So a couple other small things. Other issues. Here again, I think the district court committed error by not abstaining in the first instance from even handling it. Case where it's a clear case of reactive forum shopping, whereby there was a underlying case proceeding in the state court that involved state law issues, involved Landmark as a party.
If we take up abstention now, what's the status of the state court litigation?
State court litigation has been resolved.
Nothing to abstain to, is there?
I think it's just another point of error, I guess, Your Honor.
But again, we're not preparing you with questions on the key issues. I don't see what it leads to. Okay, we could say the district court maybe should have done that a couple years ago. It didn't. Time marches on. There's nothing we can do about that.
Well, I don't think there's anything you can do about it, except you can say the district court should never have reached this decision. Never should have reached the summary judgment motions. Never should have reached these cases at all. And that could be another basis for reversal. I will go at this point in time if there's no questions.
All right, thank you. Mr. Whittington?
Good morning, Your Honors, or for Judge Hellman, good afternoon. May it please the court. I think where it's important to begin here is that under California law, and really for the law of every state in America, is with the duty to defend. And the duty to defend is the hallmark, and if not the most important aspect of these types of policies. And under the duty to defend, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of cases talking about what an insurance company is required to do. When a claim comes in, they are required to immediately, if there is the potential of coverage, they are required to appoint defense counsel. Going along with that duty to defend also is the right to defend. And the issue, and the reason why that is so important, is because that ultimately they will be responsible not only for the payment of defense costs, but potentially for indemnity payments. And so what happens is that right to control.
Let me jump ahead a little bit. There are lots of cases about this. Not many of the cases, indeed, I don't think I've encountered any, deal with the multiple insurance company problem, because it's just not realistic to say each insurance carrier has the absolute right to control what happens, unless that insurance carrier volunteers to be unilaterally and totally responsible for what the result is. Your client wasn't saying, we'll be responsible for everything, so we get to control. So what is it that gives your client the authority to control what everybody else does in a circumstance where your client's not solely liable?
And it's an excellent question, Your Honor. And I would say that there is case law because of these large-scale construction situations where there are multiple counsel that come on board. A lot of times there are multiple law firms that get brought on to defend the case. And what ultimately happens is that the insurance companies end up working together and working with the defense counsel.
And that's what did not happen here, because your client initially joined in that process and then decided it was going to appoint somebody different. And that seemed to be the unilateral act that broke up what usually happens.
Well, no, I would.
So just, why does your client have the authority to do that,
Your Honor? Because I would disagree that it was a unilateral act, in the sense that they are entitled. That's what the case law and the policy provides.
Stop right there. Because you just explained to me, and I, in my court days, dealt with some of those cases. What happens, which is that the carriers figure out how they're going to work together and share a defense. And in this instance, there was apparently, maybe not an agreement, but there was a sharing arrangement in place. And it was your client that said, no, we're going to appoint different counsel. And you say it's not unilateral. I don't see anybody else's fingerprints on that decision.
Actually, there was, Your Honor. Travelers had initially made the decision to appoint the Lee firm, and there was another insurance company, I think it was Arch, had also joined and had also retained the Lee firm. And
we see how it's worked out for Travelers. Why should this case be any different than what our panel did last year?
Because, well, first off, Your Honor, I would disagree with the characterization of what the panel said, because what the panel did, it did not reverse and remand. What it did was it vacated the decision whether Travelers had been substantially prejudiced.
All of we do the same thing.
Because here there is a I think for two reasons, John. The first is that, contrary to what counsel said and which he says in his brief, there is ample evidence in the underlying record in our brief that Landmark was absolutely substantially prejudiced.
How? What was the prejudice?
Oh, yeah. Let me ask you about that, Mr. Whittington. So you make a lot out of the fact that I claimed that the Lee firm didn't keep them up to date and that they imposed limitations on them and didn't send them depositions, when in fact all of that stuff had gone to Youngerman and McKnight. How does that help us? I'm not It's nice color and it's nice to talk about. I'm not sure I understand the relevance.
The context, yes, Your Honor. What happened here was that the Youngerman firm did not have the requisite experience in defending a case like this, and they ended up billing about $15 million on a case that did not warrant it, and it was a big case. But what ended up happening was there was a call beforehand, and this is part of the underlying record, that where they were on board and multiple carriers made the determination that Youngerman wasn't qualified to handle a case of this magnitude. Then what happened was Youngerman, there was an agreement that the Lee firm appointed by Travelers and Landmark, they were splitting up the work because it was such a large case. They were splitting up the work, and then the Lee firm was sending its reports to the Youngerman firm so that they could put them together and send them on to the client. What happened was that Mr. Youngerman, and I will say this as a matter of record, lied about the fact that those reports were not being received, told Taisei that they weren't being received, and somehow convinced Taisei to say fire the Lee firm for not doing what it was required to do.
So and how does that get to
substantial prejudice? Of it, Your Honor, is the idea that the each carrier, it ends up working out, but each carrier is entitled to make that determination. So what happens is that at the time there is a breach of the duty, and this is the important point, is that by firing defense counsel, which is what they did, they took away that right of the carrier to defend. Now, I hear, Your Honor, Judge Clifton, your point about the fact of how this works together, and I understand. But the issue before us today is that each carrier does have that right. They did have the right to appoint separate counsel, and it ended up they were working together.
Well, you said it to you, they don't actually have the right. I was in court one day when the judge told multiple attorneys paid by separate carriers trying to represent the defendant, it doesn't work that way. You got one defendant, you got one defense. You guys have to figure it out, but I'm not going to hear from three attorneys purporting to represent the same.
Agreed. And Mr. Youngerman was
and the counsel. I want to take a step beyond that, because I think we really need to hear, not just theoretically, what's the actual prejudice? Because California law does specify a requirement to show substantial prejudice, and what is it?
So I would address that in two ways. Number one is that the substantial prejudice law came out of cases from about 50 years ago in first-party auto cases. They are not...
Is this aiming at telling me that there's not such a requirement in California law, or are you going to eventually tell me what the substantial prejudice is?
It's both, Your Honor. It's in the first instance, there is substantial prejudice law, but that applies first off in first party auto cases. It applies in notice. Okay. Now, in a separate context, was there prejudice here? The prejudice was that the carrier, my client, had to use a defense counsel that it did not want to use. The problem with that, Your Honor, is that what it does is and ended up having to pay $900,000 when that right of the duty to defend was abrogated by their action.
Counsel, let me just clarify. So you made the point earlier. Are you trying to say that if we remanded, we would be able to come forward and say your client was required to pay $15 more in legal fees than it would have? Or are you trying to say you don't have to prove that?
Your Honor, they billed $15 million in total, and that was split between about a dozen carriers. And so overall,
well, is there some X number that you think right. You were damaged by?
Understood. And yes, Your Honor, is the idea that the counsel, the reason why my client did not want to use Mr. Youngerman is that, quite frankly, he didn't know what he was doing. He did not know how to handle these cases, and that is why the billing was so excessive, and they were not going to be able to get the information that it required in order to make a determination down the line about indemnity. And that is why, when you take away that right, what is happening is that the duty to defend, they made a determination to fire the Lee firm. They made that determination based on the fact that they thought he wasn't doing a good job. Let's assume that the Lee firm wasn't. That then puts the burden, first off, it abrogates all of the case law that says that a carrier is not an insurer of the quality of the work provided by the defense counsel. They have to provide quality defense counsel, which the Lee firm was. I dispute that they did anything wrong, and the record shows that. But even assuming they did, the insured's remedy in that situation is to sue the defense counsel for legal malpractice. That it is not their remedy to fire them. Additionally, even if the insured, let's say they mentioned in the brief that there was exposure excess of the limits, which there wasn't here, but even if there was, that would, let's say there was a reservation of rights saying that if there is excess liability, then we reserve our rights on that, the insured would still not be able to retain its own counsel. That is California case law. So what is happening is they're turning, by doing this, by saying we, Taisei, get to make a decision. You have the duty and right to defend, but you are allowed, we, Taisei, as an insured, are allowed to simply fire the defense counsel that has been appointed and that was on the case for 20 months. They had no issue with it. That all of a sudden they made a determination they wanted to fire this firm. That takes away the carrier's right and duty to defend, which is what all the case law is about. So now, instead of it being a duty to defend policy, it now becomes a substantial prejudice policy. And to make this determination is literally thrown out the door because they can fire them when they want to.
California case law requires a showing of substantial prejudice. You may say that throws the case law you prefer out the door, but the California case law says what it says. And I'm still waiting to hear what actual substantial prejudice has been shown.
The actual substantial prejudice, Your Honor, is the $900,000 that they...
That can't be right because... Your client was obligated to provide a defense. You would have to show that the $900,000 was an excess of what you would have had to have paid. There's no evidence of that in the record.
I would disagree, Your Honor, because actually what the trial court said was that, and this is at the excerpt of record, page 31, at line starting at line 15, the court said, Taisei's conclusion that the Lee firm was not performing adequately was apparently based largely on its position, Taisei's position, that the Lee firm was not billing enough in comparison to the two other law firms defending Taisei. And the reason for that, Your Honor, was exactly what was happening, which was that the Youngerman law firm was billing it at a tremendous rate that did not need to happen. And so that is the delta. We have the bills from beforehand, and we have the bills that they had to pay after, and that was what the court said. But even more so is the...
I got to tell you, I don't understand how that establishes anything. I can give at least two factual scenarios that would lead to that result, and they're very different scenarios. The alternative scenario, which is suggested in the opening brief, is that the law firm that you appointed decided it didn't have to do anything. And so simply skated, and as a result, that doesn't tell me that your client has been substantially prejudiced. Indeed, your client's paying the smaller legal fee. That doesn't suggest substantial prejudice to Landmark at all.
But, Your Honor, that's exactly what the court said, was that that's what they said that they were doing. But the record shows that the Lee firm was going to every single deposition, every single site inspection, every single court appearance. They were doing all the work, they just weren't billing it like the younger
men. Counsel, isn't your burden, I'm sorry for going over this, isn't your burden to show that the Lee firm could have settled the case for a smaller amount than what the settlement ultimately was?
Your Honor, I disagree with that contention, because the idea is that then therefore that's the reason why these first party auto cases and carrying that over into a third party liability situation simply doesn't work. Because what happens is that you have, let's say there aren't multiple other carriers. Let's just say that the insured hires the law firm that the insurance company appointed. In that situation, what happens is the carrier then has no recourse. Travelers went and said, you're off the case, we withdraw from the defense. Taisei said, no, you can't do that. We continue to defend and then file the lawsuit. Taisei says, no, you can't do that. So the only remedy so that a carrier has to enforce its obligation to defend is to wait until the end of the case, 3-4 years down the road, and somehow try to prove that there was a different outcome. If I was a policyholder counsel, I would tell my client every time that to simply wait a little while and fire the counsel and put on who you want. That throws the Cumas law, independent counsel, out the window. That throws everything out the window. We lose the right to defend because they get to make a decision and say, you have to prove substantial prejudice at the end of the day. That simply can't work.
All right.
Context. I think it's important to recognize that Taisei was being defended. College. There were 11 or 12 other carriers through Taisei's primary carrier, Compo, who were defending. And that goes to the issue of substantial prejudice. This is not a case where firing counsel, as he says, or asking that counsel to withdraw, meant that there was an indemnity exposure to Landmark, because Taisei was defended the entire time through other counsel. So there's no substantial contribution by Landmark. They don't even claim it. There wasn't any contribution by Landmark to the resolution of the underlying Wilshire-Vermont case. So they paid nothing in any indemnity. These claims about Younger Mason, your honors, I frankly submit to you that they're simply not in the record. These claims that Mr. Youngerman and the counsel for Taisei lied, simply not in the record, wasn't capable, that's simply not in the record and not true. In that decision, except for the principle and dispositive fact that this matter was decided after the resolution of the Wilshire-Vermont case. That's the sole basis that the remand happened in Travelers, was to determine whether or not there had been substantial prejudice in light of the resolution. Well, here we have the resolution, and Landmark did not pay anything, was not harmed at all by that resolution, cannot establish any substantial prejudice. Landmark claims that the prejudice is they didn't have the right to use the counsel they wanted to use, but that's not prejudice at all. And in fact, they now point to this $800,000 or $900,000 they claim they spent through the Younger making that firm after July 20th, 2015, but that was purely voluntary. They decided to join that firm. They trumpet the duty to defend, but they don't like the fact that they had to pay defense costs. That's not prejudice, I would submit. And the question of could they have settled for less? Well, we have what's in the record. If you look at page 19 of our brief, there are citations to their two 30B6 witnesses, an outside adjuster and their own corporate witness, Castro and Ms. Merrick, who say that they had no objections to the resolution, how much was paid. I don't think that Mr. Whittington at all can point to any substantial prejudice that occurred here. And therefore, I don't think this matter needs to be reversed. Instructions that judgment be entered on behalf of Taisei, because they're substantial prejudice was never pleaded, never proven, and cannot.
Okay, counsel. Actual substantial prejudice grew out of the first party defender cases. And here, they have to make that showing because you don't even, your client would not even have to say there's a conflict of interest in, to get the right to hire another counsel. What's your response to that?
I think the QMIS or the 2860 argument is really a red herring, because in a 2860 environment, what the insured is trying to do is to get the carrier to pay for the insured's own selected counsel here. But that's not what was happening here, Your Honor. Taisei wanted a performing counsel. And I think the inference is really pretty clear here. Landmark and Travelers didn't want to join in what proved to be a very expensive defense in a case that had, you know, it was a construction defects. Massive, massive attorney's fees, $15 million, Mr. Whittington is correct. There was also some $15 million of costs, principal expert costs. Landmark and Travelers simply did not want to join that and have to share in the real actual burden of that. But Taisei, in asking the Lee firm to withdraw, wasn't asking that Landmark be forced to pay for its own selected counsel. That's not what was happening. It's a parade of horribles that it will free up an insured to suddenly be able to pick its own counsel. It's simply not what usually happens. If you look outside the typical construction defect situation, you typically have one carrier, one defense counsel. Why would an insured simply fire defense counsel appointed by the carrier only to have to pick up the fence all by itself? As California law says, one of the principal benefits of insurance policy is the duty to defend that is provided to an insured, and insured at defense, which is the principal benefit oftentimes in this situation.
No further questions. Landmark American Insurance Company versus Taisei Construction Corporation will be submitted. We'll take up EHM Productions versus Starline Tours of Hollywood.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel.